Well, it's just a pleasure to welcome back Bob Hoy, the institutional advisor here. He's advised clients 3 decades, editor, chief investment strategist. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Hi, Chris. Good to be with you.
Great to have you back with us today. And, you know, the topic du jour, I don't think I even need to mention it. I've been working on a Bitcoin valuation model. I'm looking at some of the great folks out there, and I have to tip my hat to Professor Andreas Antonopoulos. And he really is the Bitcoin evangelical, if you will, on the subject. And he doesn't even have a home. He's just like Paul Erdős, you might recall, the great mathematician who was mildly autistic and bounced from mathematician's home to mathematician's home around the world. That's what this individual has done. And taking a lot of his work and applying Metcalfe's law to it, I've got a forecast here, a model that is putting out the current numbers and some interesting projections I'd like to share with you. Now, based on Metcalfe's law, that basically says any network system, which Bitcoin is a network, the internet is a network, an email system is a network, you just take the number of users, you square that number, and multiply it by the average transaction rate. So then we take Cambridge University's, and that's the widely accepted number to use, of Bitcoin users, and I took the mean value, which I haven't seen anyone do yet, because they have a wide range from about 1.5 million users worldwide to about 6 million. It gave me 4.2 million folks. I squared it and multiply it by the daily average transaction rate, which you can find online, has a very wide range as well, which I think explains a lot of the volatility we're seeing in the price. So it ranges anywhere from 1,400 per day, transactions per day, to around 1,600. By the number of users, and it gives us right around $5,500. That's approximately where we are today. How do you figure out or project the growth rate of Bitcoin users? Turn to Google's trend analysis. As you may know, they have a fantastic service there. You can find the trend of almost anything, and they just happen to have this for Bitcoin users. It's very similar, if you will, to Moore's law, but not quite as strong. It doubles every year. So here's my basic model, sans the regulatory and competitive adjustments that I do think need, you know, altcoin competition is important there. And then, of course, the regulatory issues will become more and more important and probably sooner than later. But let's just have this basic back of the envelope. 2018 price projection, about 8 million users, about 1,500 transactions, and that's just a slight growth rate. If you look over time, the last 8 years or so, we've had a very slow inflation in the number of daily transactions. So I just added a little less than 7% to the daily transaction number. We come to a Bitcoin price of 12,000. That would be this time next year to 2019. So 2 years from now, we should have approximately 15 to 16 million users. We square that by 1,600 average daily transactions, and we come up with 25,600. I know it may sound fantastic, but Cliff High, who is arguably one of the internet's biggest evangelicals on this other than Andreas, is calling for 25 to 27,000 early as the next 4 months. I do think the volatility will be extremely high. These numbers need to be adjusted for competition and, as I mentioned, regulatory constraints. But I wanted to toss that out to you, Bob, and see what you thought.
Well, I think it's very methodical what you're doing. And, I remember decades and decades ago when I was in the research department of a huge investment dealer, trainee, and we were doing a cigarette company, Imperial Tobacco, I don't know. Anyways, so the guy I was working said, well, Bob, just figure out how many cigarettes they sold last year and how much money they made per cigarette, and let's forecast it for the next quarter or the next week. And actually, it worked out, and we were in a bull market. Stock was going up. But at any rate, the earnings forecast done that way did work. But
until it didn't work.
That is the truth of the whole world, of history, of politics, of biology, of physics, of everything. It works until it no longer works.
Actually made my next point for me, and that is that the world is just not necessarily quite so linear. Let me also discuss the other side of that equation that I think might be applicable here, at least maybe for just 2 or 3 more years. The reason why I think this time it might work until it doesn't work for another year or two, unlike other markets, it's still virtually impossible to short and contain this financial viral epidemic It's really a pandemic, if you will. Let me give you an example. You may have read recently, I think it's Madagascar, there's been a horrific outbreak of the bubonic plague.
I think the bacteria is pestis. If you get it soon enough with antibiotics, it's easier to get killed than a virus. But nonetheless, and it is, you know, the plague is extent everywhere, all through Mongolia, any dry regions where there are ground rodents, they're the main host. If you do something different, or like I've read about it in Arizona, guys go into an old shack, stir the dust up a little bit, and then the next thing you know, they've got bubonic plague.
What I'm trying to get to here is the anti-fragility aspects of this blockchain revolution. You might recall creator of the Black Swan and, of course, Fooled by Randomness, Nassim Taleb. He also wrote a book called Anti-Fragile. And we want systems that are anti-fragile. Stock markets, they're fragile. Bond markets are fragile. Anywhere there's a market that has, unlike the internet and blockchain, that doesn't have the redundancy of the system built in, it tends to be extremely fragile. Before we get to the fragility aspects, let's just take a step back. One of the interesting things here that I think our policymakers still can't understand is there is no centralized Bitcoin. In other words, each transaction takes place between you and your neighbor. Brings an iPhone and you bring an iPhone or an Android, and you just swipe each other's phones there and they read each other's QR codes. No intermediary, no third party has stepped in an authoritarian manner and demanded payment. Here's an example. If say you wanted to use a credit card, you couldn't do it. If you are not a business owner, you cannot take your Visa or your MasterCard or even your debit card for that matter, just walk over there and swipe it and transact. You have to have at least two to three third parties verification, all of whom are extracting rates and fees. They might say, hey, we don't want to work with you anymore because you're homeless or we don't like your address. You're outspoken. This happens much more frequently than people know. So enter the blockchain, this anti-fragile system with no centralized authority. Anyone can mine their own central banker. Suddenly, 7 billion inhabitants have access to a checking account, savings account, investment account to transact instantaneously without authority stepping in. Watch Dr. Antonopoulos speaking before all the authorities and the Senate of Canada. They were just going on and on. Well, who owns it? No one. Who controls it? Can it be hacked? Nope. It's hack-proof. So you might be thinking, now, what do you mean hack-proof? Well, I actually spent the last few days rereading Satoshi Nakamoto's paper. If you pull the abstract out and the references, it's less than 7 pages long. It's Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. This is the onus of this great revolution we've run into. It's readable by virtually anyone. There's only a little bit of mathematics, and that's a Poisson discussion. But really, in two or three sentences, you can summarize this amazing paper. What he really said is just this. We have to remove trust from all financial transactions. What do you mean remove trust? When it involves trust, it means you must have a third party, someone with a sword. But if we can find a way in a peer-to-peer format to eliminate that sword, we can eliminate trust by using cryptos. And the problem had been the double spending problem. They solved it. I'm estimating just over 2 million people in the United States are users of Bitcoin. Okay, so that's let's just say 2 to 3 million. That's 1%. In Europe, in Asia, 2 to 3 million in each region. So that's interesting because it's also less than 1% in each region. If we plug in the growth rates of where this is headed into any formula, Metcalf's or mine or any of the others out there, 3% or 5% in that region, not the ultimate 50 to 100% that's coming. I have come to the conclusion, and rather late to the party, I might add, that this is bit gold. Bitcoin is digital gold. The reason why Bitcoin is actually better, and incidentally, 4 to 5 times gold's price. In the digital world, you copy your forecasts, you copy your newsletters, you make thousands, tens of thousands of copies for your subscribers. We do this all the time. You remember the days when you had to fax it by hand to everybody, or worse, send it via snail mail? We don't even think twice about sending 10 or 20,000 emails. out to people today. Bitcoin is just the opposite of this. And there has never been a time in the history of electronic commerce, let's say 50 years, where this has occurred. Unlike your emails, your Word documents, your PDFs, okay, that we copy all day long and everything else, copy, paste, or clone it. Bitcoin is the first time, Bob, where you can say, I have this Bitcoin, which is just a digital signature, I might say, which has been hashed with a timestamp. This Bitcoin over here with a different digital signature and hashed at a slightly different time. It's the only time where you could have 21 billion coins that are each signed differently. They're the same, but they're different. Well, what do you think a bit of gold is? Is the same, but separate. This is digital gold that can be transferred without the incredibly expensive insurance and transfer rates. No, I am not giving up on gold and silver, but if you don't have 5% in Bitcoin.
Yeah, you're right. And the way I look at it, Chris, is that history has been in now an experiment in authoritarian government that's run for some, well, let's say it began around 1895 or 1900, so it's 120 years. And I'm not talking about authoritarian governments in banana republics. I'm talking about the senior economy, the Western world. And there have been only two of those in the past. The first one was a decent country, Rome, a decent republic for the day, and in the 3rd century it turned into a vicious police state because the bureaucracy went out of control, and the big banner was the genius of the empire, of the emperor, and they went until there was no money left, and it fell apart. That's the simple explanation of the collapse of the Roman civilization. And then there was no money around until the 1500, when the bullion started coming over from the New World. And then that was able to fund the ambitions of a bureaucracy. Spain was the leading country. And they showed, as they did in Roman times, that the greatest amount of bullion treasure in history wasn't enough. They had to borrow money and then they had to depreciate the coinage. So, when a country goes authoritarian, even an almost the biggest treasury you can imagine is not enough. So anyways, then that one ended in the early 1600s. It was they called it the Protestant Reformation, but I would call it a Great Reformation because society looked at every institution, and if it wasn't useful, or if it was predatory, it was bypassed. So then you, so the from the 1600s on, and England is the nicest place to look at it because they have a higher regard for freedom. So then they then insisted on a sound currency, constrained government, a limited government, and the sovereignty of the individual. And that ran until about 1900, and then you, even if you knew about the two previous experiments of authoritarian government, you would not, in 1900, be able to forecast another one. So here we are now, same thing. This time the wealth wasn't confiscated treasure. It was created by modern business and technical and industry and stuff like that. So anyways, it's run its course. People now are fed up with in-your-face and in your wallet government, which was the same problem back at the collapse of Rome, and they're starting to react against it. Let's call it popular uprising, and it will be successful. Now, the public in the United States is attempting to restore government by the people. I wished I'd thought of the phrase. Your founding fathers came up with the phrase. And that's the political side. They're going to take back government from bureaucracy and experts. Now, with this, they will also, when they figure it out, will have a sound currency, a sound money, a sound coinage, a sound unit of transaction, a means of saving, all that we attribute a gold standard currency with. And they will have it, Chris. And this is where the cryptocurrencies and the blockchain will allow it. It'll be the tool. Now, how you end up with a unit that is relatively constant in value, I don't know. But it will happen. So we are in extremely exciting times, unseen in 400 years. Exciting if you have a regard for limited government and individual freedom. This also works with regionalism because, Chris, you've got the young politician from Austria, center-right, and now there's a guy, a wealthy guy in the Czech Republic has suddenly arisen and created. So the symptom of authoritarianism in Europe, of course, is the EU, and I've called it Moscow. Brussels is Moscow on the Maastricht, which is a good phrase, but it's not quite geographically accurate. But so far, we've been fortunate. While they're an unelected bureaucracy, they have yet to assume the ultimate privilege, which is the privilege of state murder, which Moscow did have. So this is the way around it, Chris. This popular uprising, it'll push the bureaucrats down, and the voter will ascend, and it'll be government by the people, and they will have their money, and they will have sound money, and as I said, the Bitcoin and the blockchain will enable sound money at some time, and I don't know, I'm not sophisticated enough to figure out how to do it, but the wizards in the cyber side will figure it out.
At the end of the day, this centralization of money has extracted a heavy toll. It is fractional banking. Case in point, you want to purchase a home. You walk into the lender's office. Well, today, you're on the phone and punching numbers online and comparing 3 different lenders or 10 different lenders online. You get the phone call and they agree, yes, sir, you've worked so hard. You have 4 credit cards. You pay on time. We're so impressed with your credit and we'll take a bet on you. Now, let's look at what that bet entails. We will give you that nice $479,500 for that shack of a house, which, by the way, if it was built in the last 5 or 10 years, will not hold together another 10 years. Put down 10% or 5%, if even that today, because they're now tossing money to anyone who can fog a mirror. When they pay that dollar amount, let's say it's $450,000, to the builder, and to the other various parties, it's a 1 to 10 or 10 to 1 fractional reserve. It's mostly created out of thin air, somewhere between 90 and 99%, depending on how you do this. You will have, depending on the interest rate, paid for that home somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 to 300% the initial price, which is why I believe the whole system needs to be overhauled. What this means is even if you're one of the elite, the few who kind of make it into the middle class or the next level higher, you are still trapped in a system that is designed to extract every penny from your family until the day you pass. And then along comes this system that says, I don't care if you're homeless and you just found an iPhone or Android in a trash can. It's a checking account for everyone. It's instant payment for everyone. It does not involve any third parties, 2 or 3 intermediaries between you and your peer. One final thing. I know there's a lot of preppers who listen to this show. Let's say everyone I talk to keeps saying, oh, well, you know, if the internet goes out or what have you, I mean, there's no way for you to really transact in bitcoins. Well, I'm afraid that's just not true. You can go and get a paper wallet, and it's totally free. You can simply print out that paper wallet. It's encrypted. Print out 2 or 3 copies. Put it in a little fireproof safe, a $10, $15 fireproof safe, and those are out of the system. The power goes out. Everything's down. You can hand that piece of paper to your neighbor. I don't think after listening to Canada's legislators yesterday, as Mr. Antonopoulos was giving probably the most remarkable speech, maybe I'm exaggerating,
since 1776. I believe this is the Constitutional Convention. But instead of having a room of maybe 50 bright people, it was him and the Parliament or the Senate of Canada. And this speech that I will be posting in video format with this interview today is quite possibly the most profound, I think, in finance and probably financial history, which you're also the expert in, 300 years.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. This, the revolution in the early 1600s and throwing off the state, while printing it started in the late 1400s with the movable print, it didn't become effective until the early 1600s, when there was a rising middle class that could afford to buy books and pamphlets that were against the state. The state had the monopoly on the media, both in printing because of its expense, and also because in England, with the Anglican Church, they had the bully pulpit all around. So this is what ordinary people took on, and it took 100 years, but they eventually won. And the final part that really locked it in for ordinary people was in England in 1688. It was called the Glorious Revolution, and it was essentially guided by businessmen in London, Protestants. But it had the general public, it was a popular uprising, and they, at the time, James, the king, was authoritarian, and he was threatening to bring troops from France, Catholic France, to England to subdue the people. Instead, and there was not much bloodshed, the will of the people overwhelmed him. And it was a profound political change. And James went to France, sought solace in authoritarian France. So what made it work was that people could afford to use the new media. And at the time, Archbishop Laud at the Star Chamber was the authoritarian thing, and if you didn't toe the party line, you'd have your cheek branded and your ears lopped off. You might get killed. But at any rate, they took on a formidable foe, and they won. And so here we have now, and this is where Trump's tweeting is the equivalent. It's getting around the monopoly, the authoritarian monopoly on the media. And it is becoming very effective. And it's remarkable times, Chris. And I am just so pleased to be alive and vertical and understanding the full potential of what's going on here. So what you've had here is with both the internet and, of course, the cyber coins is part of it, and the chain is part of it. And so along comes a vehicle that helps a great reformation, and this is what we have.
And I believe you'll be vertical through some incredibly exciting times, because it looks as though, and again, the world is far from linear, so let's not get too excited, but if the trend persists with lots of dips and valleys along the way, in the next 2 years, in what would really be, I think, the onus of a new revolution, when that tipping point is crossed, there's no turning back, the regulators are still stymied here.
That this is going to be accelerated because the stock market is reaching levels unseen since 1987 in one series, in one measure, right now. And our work suggests that somewhere in the next month or so, the stock market is going to roll over. And the bear market will be very severe. And then the folks are going to take a look at central banking and policy making, and say, look it, you wagered all of our taxes on buying asset prices, and now assets are crashing. So there will be a severe condemnation of policymaking, which is what you need. And then, of course, it looks like we're going to go in. There's cooling going on in the climate. And then the state, of course, backed the wrong side of that. So there will be embarrassment there. So to make great promotions by the state that they can control the climate and can control the economy will be seen to be abject failures. So this and both the this winter in Northern Hemisphere could be cold and there could be a bear market. So this will accelerate the collapse of the state monopolies and opening up the door for alternatives. And I would like to leave it at that, Chris.
It's well said. And let me just throw a couple of forecasts out here as we wrap up today. A couple of outcomes worth contemplating, points to ponder. One of the mistakes that we make as humans is to think linearly. And of course, the world is a little more cyclical than that. It has some twists and turns and randomness thrown in there. Think about Metcalfe's formula for a minute. It's just the number of users squared times transactions. Let's just keep it simple. We all know that exponential is not linear. Well, when I say exponential, that's what that squared means. You see, so we're looking at the square of the number of users. So people think, oh, well, we've got 3 million or 4 million worldwide. When we go to 6, 7, 8 million, you have to square that. In 5 years, we could be at 50,000. Or in 10 years, we could be at 50,000. No, folks, due to the exponential nature, instead of when there's 10 million, maybe you're at 50,000. My forecast is suggesting $500,000 Bitcoin projection if there isn't some earthquake event. So I want to go on record saying that I think we could see 500,000 to 1.5 million. Again, lots of provisos, not a forecast. I just think it is a possibility. I'd also like to add that we're looking at a blockchain that will revolutionize the way that we vote from any location, from their cell phones or from a, you know, let's say a library. Homeless people pull out the bureaucracy, the waste, the lack of transparency, and it will inject truth and honesty and forthrightness. Please tell people more about the institutional advisor.
Yep, you can get in touch with us at institutionaladvisors.com, or you can just put in my name into the Google, but B-O-B-H-O-Y-E, and it all comes up. So, and you can review our archives, track history, all that sort of stuff. And we are in particularly fascinating times right now.
All right, Bob Hoy. We'll look forward to the next talk.
Okay, Chris. We'll talk to you later.
With stocks hitting new highs, the next sector to fly could be the precious metals. GoldSeek's top industry analyst just uncovered another solid gold opportunity, Silvercorp Metals. Silvercorp's key property is located in China, the largest gold producer in the world. Silvercorp's net income is soaring, up 589%. Production eclipsed guidance by 27.5%, totaling 6.5 million ounces. Mining operations are literally printing silver at only $3.82 per ounce. AISC net byproducts credits for the fiscal year 2017. Sales increased 51% year over year, and cash flow from operations more than doubled to $80 million. Silvercorp continues to set the industry standard with reduced costs, equity appreciation, a solid dividend, and improved free cash flow. Silvercorp is uniquely positioned to capitalize on rising silver, lead, and zinc prices. To learn more about the exceptional opportunity in Silvercorp Inc., direct your web browser to silvercorpmetals.com, ticker symbol SVM in the U.S. and Canada. Remember to treat your portfolio with a core position in Silvercorp Metals.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.